Behind every statistic is a story. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, May 28th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we recap our SDPB May spotlight on missing and murdered Indigenous women. We'll talk history and vulnerability, searching and healing. We also hear from SDPB's Richard Tubles. He'll share a story of a relative who was missing for decades before her remains were identified hundreds of miles away from home. Eliza Blue contemplates life when your to-do list remains unfinished. Plus, the Sioux Falls Jazz and Blues Society brings summer jazz events back to the region in a big way. We'll talk about an arts organization, a community, and a return to the celebration of live music. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in the SDPB Sioux Falls Studios. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. A medical marijuana program becomes law in about a month, but state officials say medical cannabis won't be available until 2022. The law gives the state until October to set up a licensing system. State Secretary of Health Kim Mulsom-Risden says that pushes things back.
The idea is that nobody would be eligible to be growing before they applied and were approved. And so that in and of itself backs it up. Then by the time you have grown a crop and harvested it and cultivated it and done all the things to make sure it's safe, you know, it just adds to the timeline.
One state official says it takes about 90 days to grow a usable plant from seed to product ready for sale. The state is contracting with a cannabis consulting group. The group is analyzing how many South Dakotans may be eligible for a medical marijuana card. State lawmakers are spending the summer studying marijuana after voters approved both recreational and medical cannabis in November. A high school student from South Dakota is the National Poetry Out Loud champion. Poetry Out Loud is a national program dedicated to arts education. It offers a competition for high school students to recite poems. Raheel Magosha of Sioux Falls will receive $20,000 for winning the competition Thursday night. She recited three poems, including Breakfast by Mary Lamb.
With which again our friends we greet, when in the breakfast room we meet, at the social table round, listening to the lively sound of those notes which never tire.
Finals were held virtually this year. Judges scored competitors on categories such as physical presence, articulation, and accuracy. A new organization in Sioux Falls wants to make art more accessible by showing it in people's backyards. SDPB's Megan Feary has more.
Back Artigans has its first show Friday. Co-founder Hannah Grapevine says she can't believe it's actually happening.
It's crazy. We didn't realize that this little idea that spurred over coffee was going to become this big.
Grapevine graduated last year from Augustana University with an art degree. She applied for numerous jobs in her field.
And almost every single one was terminated before I even graduated. So I kind of had no prospects.
Grapevine says the pandemic put the industry on hold. Galleries closed and artists had fewer opportunities to showcase their work. Grapevine and two friends created Back Artigans to help.
So we kind of brand ourselves as a backyard art experience. We're a gallery without walls, and we're also a mobile gallery, so we're able to move between different spaces.
Grapevine says the positive response and support for Back Artigans is overwhelming. Rachel Funk is a local potter. She says 2020 burned her out, both creatively and financially. But she can't wait to show her work this week in a safe space.
I know that the concept of it came from COVID safety precautions because they weren't sure where we were going to be at as far as what the CDC recommended come May and then throughout the rest of the summer. So that's really exciting to be social in an outdoor space where I feel like most people there are going to be fully vaccinated.
15 artists will display their work. There will be food for sale and live music. The event starts at 6:30 at 810 South Main Street. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
For weather today, mostly sunny skies statewide with highs in the lower 60s to the lower 70s. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota's newest veterans cemetery is being dedicated at a public event on Memorial Day. SDPB's Brenda Wade Schmidt brings us an update on what to expect in the first months of opening.
On a grassy knoll just minutes from South Dakota's largest city, a quiet peace envelops a new cemetery for veterans to be laid to rest. Initially, there's room for 2,319 service members and their spouses to be buried in the next 3 to 5 years. Erin Brown is a cemetery director. She says so far, 1,500 people have pre-applied, stating their plans to make the cemetery their final resting place.
We do have a full month of June and July of burials that are already scheduled. Some are veterans or spouses who have passed away recently. Some of them are from, you know, a couple years ago that the family is ready to complete that burial right now.
Families are given 20 minutes in the committal shelter where they can sing, read scriptures, pray, and have clergy or family members speak. Brown says they also receive the folded United States flag in honor of their veteran.
So we have the ability to complete 7 burials in one day. We can do one every hour, and we would start at 9. So we could do a 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, or 3. That 3 o'clock burial being only cremains. So either a columbarium burial or an in-ground urn placement. At a veteran cemetery, we don't do a graveside service. All of our services with the families would be held in our committal shelter.
The veteran cemetery was built out of 60 acres that were donated by the city of Sioux Falls. Construction started in September of 2019, a job that included sculpting a hill into the landscape where the flags of all branches of the military surround a scattering garden. The first 13 acres of the cemetery also have 610 prepared underground vaults with room for 2 caskets each, 999 spaces for in-ground urns, 660 spots on a columbarium wall, and 50 spots on a memorial wall at the scattering garden. Bill Peters is the Honor Guard commander for the Sioux Falls American Legion Post 15. He says his group will conduct military rites for many of the services, which include, at minimum, a flag-folding ceremony and the playing of taps. In recent years, the Honor Guard has done between 120 and 140 funerals that require up to 14 volunteers. Those numbers of services will increase this year with the opening of the new state cemetery, including 5 funerals they've initially been asked to do in June. Peters says he volunteers because he wants families to know that their loved one was a hero who fought for this country.
I enjoy doing it. The veteran that's passed away deserves it. Not only deserves it, but he has the right to it.
The cemetery's capacity for the anticipated next 100 years is 28,519 burials, says Brown, who works in an office that opened in January on the grounds. The state pays to operate the cemetery, but it is open for burials of veterans from outside of the state, too. It is held to National Military Cemetery standards.
There was a lot of dirt work and groundwork that was done for this project. When we stood here for the groundbreaking, you know, we were kind of up on a hill, almost right where this spot is now, which is now obviously the front entrance. And then looking at, you know, what type of grasses and everything we planted was all, you know, we wanted it to be some native grasses and, you know, all of that just is inviting and welcoming as soon as you come in.
For Eastern South Dakota, the cemetery is a way in which area loved ones can be closer to the resting place of their veteran. Until now, the Veterans Cemetery in Sturgis was the only other option in the state for military burials. Brown says some families with veterans interred in Western South Dakota are moving them to Sioux Falls to be closer. Veterans are buried free of charge as part of their benefits. Their spouse also can be buried with them, 2 to a gravesite, for a fee that currently is $807. Veteran Bill Peters says not every veteran can afford a burial and calls it a real benefit to veterans. Peters flew Army Huey helicopters in Vietnam. He is 74 years old now and already has made other arrangements for his burial at St. Michael's Cemetery in Sioux Falls. But he says the veteran cemetery's hallowed grounds are needed on the eastern side of the state.
It's going to be a pristine cemetery once the grass gets up and gets, you know, being able to be mowed and groomed. It's going to be a beautiful place. And this side of the state of South Dakota and the surrounding area deserves it.
The cemetery helps veterans' families know their loved one is cared for, says Aaron Brown.
That would be our overall goal, is to give the family a place of, you know, serenity and peace, and just, you know, knowing that we will be here to take care of their loved one every day, all day.
The Memorial Day dedication and the ribbon cutting at the state cemetery is expected to draw a large crowd. Aaron Brown says shuttle buses will leave from the Military Heritage Alliance building on Russell Street starting at noon because parking is not available on the grounds. The cemetery also is open during business hours on weekdays for now for anyone interested in driving through. Hours will expand to include weekends when an electronic gate is installed. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Brenda Wade-Schmidt in Sioux Falls.
Ahead on the program, Richard Tubbles has the story of a relative lost and the closure of bringing her remains home once again. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, it's Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind. Memorial Day marks the traditional beginning of summer. It's also a time to revere sacrifices made by others so that we can enjoy our freedoms. My team has put together a special hour featuring conversations about legacies and memorials. We'll learn about projects to collect soldiers' letters and to preserve veterans' memories. I hope you'll join us.
Listen Memorial Day at noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 7 Central, 6 Mountain, here on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Song of the Soldier for a Day of Remembrance. I'm Scott Simon. Please join me here for Alan Seeger, Instrument of Destiny.
Listen Memorial Day evening at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB.
Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In 1978, Juanita Adams, an enrolled member of the Oglala Lakota tribe, left Pine Ridge to participate in the American Indian Movement's longest walk. The walk started in California and ended up in Washington, D.C., where they protested certain policies that directly affected Native Americans. Adams was 19 at the time, and then she disappeared. SDPB's monthly spotlight is on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Richard Tubbles joins us today to reflect and tell us the story of his relative, Juanita Adams. Richard, thanks for being here and bringing us this story today. It's a tough one, though.
Hello, Lori. Yeah, you know, like you said, this month highlights the unfortunate narrative of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I know it's a pretty heavy topic, and we've been spotlighting it all month, but you know, we can't forget the stories and the lives that these beautiful Indigenous women live, such as Juanita Adams. And in celebration of her life, I recently spoke with another aunt of mine, Roxanne Tubbles, who grew up closely with Adams.
When we were growing up, the memories I have of her, we lived in Oglala, and they lived with my grandpa, and he was about maybe 6 miles away. So when my grandpa or one of my aunts came to visit, then we'd get to play with them. And I remember her being really athletic and being fun. And I looked forward to our visits because she always made me laugh. And she was a, you know, like a natural born comedian and knew how to impersonate people's voices. But she was real competitive. She was a good athlete. She would run really fast and, you know, she was excellent, could ride a horse. I mean, she could do everything, play baseball. She was just really gifted, and we learned a lot from each other, and we grew up as just little kids, and then teenagers, and then to the time when we parted our ways when she left.
So, Richard, the 1970s is a unique time period with the American movement activity. Tell me a little bit about what that meant for those who grew up in that era.
Yeah, I think along those lines, you know, I think there was a lot of, not necessarily upheaval, but there was a lot of people that were dissatisfied, specifically Native Americans, with the federal government and some of those issues that they didn't honor in regards to some of us who are part of what we call treaty tribes.
Right.
And according to my aunt Roxanne, though, my aunt Juanita was very active and she cared deeply for the rights of Native Americans. And I think that just kind of went with that whole status quo. And she went to participate in the longest walk that year. And I think she briefly came back to Pine Ridge.
I didn't see her then either, but that's when she never came back. And, you know, that left me, like, with over the years, she's somewhere, and I always had hope. And I even used to dream about her. One of the most prominent dreams was I was going to go catch a bus, and she was sitting there at the bus stop on a bench, and she was big and pregnant, and she didn't say hi to me or nothing. And it was like she didn't know me, and I was trying to talk to her, and the bus stopped, and the doors opened, and she just got up and got on the bus, and it drove off, and I was left standing there.
You know, in 1980, 2 years after she went to the longest walk from Pine Ridge, there was a construction crew that eventually found her remains in Georgia.
And then, you know, and then no one ever heard from her again. So there was those infrequent intervals where, you know, there was something where that indicated that she was still alive. But, you know, then there was nothing. It just was silent. And we all suffered from that. I mean, you know, she was my best friend. She was one of my best friends. And, you know, I really loved her. And she was like a sister to me. In our family, my dad's family, him and his sisters, they, you know, their children were close to the same age, so they had older kids, and then, you know, they had children about every year, so her and I were along the same time, and so we hung out a lot together.
It really breaks my heart, Lori, mm-hmm. is Juanita wasn't identified until almost three decades later, and for the longest time, she was dubbed the lady with the glass eye because she was in a car accident in her early teenage years prior to taking that trip.
One of our cousins met a friend in over the internet in Georgia, and they eventually got married and had a child, and that's where they found her, was Hall County, Georgia. So my cousin's sister was on that website, and she was trying to get information about Native people, and they came across. So they went to the website and saw a person that resembled her. And so they called my aunt, my dad's sister. And so she called her son, and he went to the website and went through it. And then she called me and asked me if I would head up, you know, spearhead the investigation, for the family investigation, to see if that was her, you know, and follow that lead. And I worked for law enforcement at the time, and so I contacted that investigator, and he said he was really surprised after 34 years someone had called. He said, somebody's looking for our girl, and he gave me the history of that case, and what had happened was Hall County, Georgia, is the northern part, and the state right next to it, I think it's right north of it. They had two interstates that were just like, you know, really close together, but they didn't have a connector. So they were building a connector there and also building a rest area. So when they were doing excavation in some trees that they had to take out, they're excavating and they found the remains.
Richard, this is such a difficult story, and so many things just came together to help your family finally be able to get some kind of closure on the whereabouts of your aunt Juanita. What happened next?
Well, my aunt Roxanne was able to identify my aunt Juanita based off of this ring that another cousin of hers gave to her, actually. So it was kind of unique in that aspect that it was it was able, you know, after all these years, she was able to identify her based off this ring. But like that, like I said earlier, that photo that they provided of her age was actually pretty accurate.
It took my breath away, and it was like, oh, there's Nita. And then I scroll down, and it has, if you have any information, call this number. And I call that number, and that's how I hooked up with that investigator. So what we did was, you know, I called him and told him, I told him details that no one else would know, you know, like the tooth and the scarring and the color of her hair and how she dressed and all of that, and that ring. And he sent that ring, and I, you know, that was her ring. And I verified it with my cousin, and she said, yeah, that's the ring I gave her. So we got DNA from her sister, and we sent it to Texas to the same laboratory that did that I helped identify the remains of the 9/11 tragedy, you know, and some of those were just like little pieces of skin or bones or anything. So it was real scientific and, you know, at the molecular level, how they did that identification. And there was a huge waiting list. So he said they probably wouldn't get done for 9 to 12 months.
But eventually they're able to bring her back home. Tell me about that, Richard.
Yeah, my Aunt Roxanne, she as soon as she was able to identify her, she started the process immediately to bring her back home to Redshirt Table here in South Dakota.
I just, you know, that just, it was just like traumatized me. And I often thought about, because I prayed for her, and I often thought about my poor cousin, you know, the last thing she saw in her eyes was this man killing her, you know, and how she probably felt, you know, lost and alone and helpless. And that really broke my heart that was, you know, that happened. And so I wanted to see this to completion, and I wanted her to come home. So I worked on it constantly, and, you know, When they verified the DNA, I hung up the phone, and I called the tribal treasurer's office and start making arrangements to bring her home, to get her out of that lab and into a mortuary to transfer her remains home.
They brought her home, and they buried her next to her mother over at Redshirt Table, where my family has kind of hailed from for over 100 years. And I believe it, I wasn't there personally, but I believe it was a beautiful sunset ceremony.
The most gratifying thought was that she's home, and she's by my aunt, and she's safe now. She's okay. She's with all the relatives. And I was relieved. I just let out a big sigh and watched that sunset. And that's the same thing she'll see, you know, someday. I live with that next.
You know, thank you, Lori, for letting me tell this story. I know it's a heavy topic, but it's one of those things where, you know, I'm really tight with my family, and I would have loved to got to know my Aunt Juanita. She sounds like she was a really strong and brave person, and, you know, her perspective on life and being a strong Native American woman, I really just want to stress that if anyone finds themselves in a deplorable situation like that, that there is always hope. And I really hope that people can reach out to somebody that can help them get out of that situation.
Richard, thank you for telling me this story and telling all of us this story. And I just want to add two things. And one, you know, this was a woman who was an activist, who cared about her community, was, you know, a leader among people at the age of 19. And you'll never know what is lost when you lose someone like that, when you lose a mother, when you lose a dancer, when you lose a leader, a politician, a scholar. It's just, it's so frustrating. And then also, I just want to say a personal thank you to you for bringing this story. It costs something for you to do this work as well. And I appreciate you sharing it and helping us carry it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Lori. I really believe that, you know, this is one of those aspects where we didn't lose hope, you know, and I just feel like this story could bring other people hope. Yeah. So thank you.
We're going to have more on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Ahead on In the Moment, you're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, 50% of American adults are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but there are still some hesitant to get the shot.
The primary challenge we face is helping the remaining segments of the American public to recognize that vaccines are really our best option.
Plus, a growing demand for an underappreciated resource, sand. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
Massachusetts has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, but racial, ethnic, and income disparities still exist.
Not speaking the language of whoever is booking the appointments on the other side. It just makes it harder to get vaccinated, right?
And there are other barriers. How organizers are using get-out-the-vote tactics to get out the vaccine. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team working together to serve your needs. Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month's SDPB Spotlight Project has focused on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We have searched the statistics. We've come alongside as people have told their stories of lost relatives and the agony of unanswered questions and delayed justice. And we've met the people who are striving to solve the problem for this generation and for the next generations to come. So why are we doing this coverage? Let's start with some statistics. If you visit the South Dakota Attorney General's Missing Persons Clearinghouse today, you'll find 107 missing persons. Now, 9 of those people are described as white women. 38 of those people are listed as American Indian women. So that means that fewer than 1% of those missing are white women, and 36% of the total missing people are Indigenous women. That number is most likely a significant undercount of the real problem for Native women. It also doesn't tell us anything about Indigenous women and girls at risk of disappearing or vulnerable to exploitation or trafficking. It is essentially a downstream number. Now, our guests have been telling us all month that many missing Indigenous women are never officially reported as missing. So we're going to begin our recap today with Nicole Martin Rogers. She's senior researcher at the Wilder Institute in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was part of Minnesota's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. That task force found that during any given month from 2012 to 2020, Minnesota had from 27 to 54 missing American Indian women. I asked her why the data on who is missing and Indigenous victims of homicide, why is all that so hard to pin down nationwide?
The first obvious answer is that there's not a single database in the state of Minnesota or nationally or in any other state that I'm aware of that tracks both missing and murdered people in one place, right? There's a number of different databases. There's a missing persons clearinghouse, and then there's a database tracking homicides. There's also different categories of homicides. There's also missing unidentified dead bodies that we don't know who they are. And within all of these different data systems, there's also the problem of misclassification of race. So sometimes American Indian people aren't classified correctly. And there's a problem of underreporting. So in the instance of missing persons, you know, sometimes we run across, we heard a number of instances during the task force process of women who had gone missing, but law enforcement declined to actually officially report them as missing because they knew of the woman's history with prostitution or drug abuse or other things and sort of deemed her to have gone off partying or something and she'll show back up. So then it doesn't reach the point of getting to an official report. There's also jurisdictional issues. So sometimes there's multiple different jurisdictions and law enforcement agencies involved, and it's not clear which one of them is going to be doing the reporting. So there's all of these barriers to getting good, accurate data and to having it all in one place. There are some voluntary databases like the Sovereign Bodies Institute that does try to keep track, but that's not a mandatory reporting system. That's just somebody who's taking their own time and taking it upon themselves to do it. And then the other thing that I would say, too, is that there's a lot of stuff that leads up to someone becoming missing or murdered. And there's a lot of other data systems that we need to look to understand those sort of upstream cases. So, for example, in Minnesota, the Department of Human Services reported that 601 American Indian children went missing out of their out-of-home placements between 2015 and 2019. And many of those children may end up being trafficked or other exploitation situations that is sort of a direct pathway to becoming MMIW. So, you know, all the data from all those different systems has to be considered if you really want to get a true picture of understanding where this injustice comes from.
That's Nicole Martin Rogers, senior researcher at Wilder Research in St. Paul. Now let's keep going with this big question. Why? How in the world can you explain why there are so many Indigenous women and girls and two-spirited people who disappear or who are victims of unsolved and disproportionately unprosecuted crimes? Nicole Martin Rogers addressed some of that, but we're going to go a little further back in time. And for that, we'll hear from Lily Mendoza. She's with the Red Ribbon Skirt Society in Rapid City, and she's also owner of Birdcage Books, and that's where you can find the Center for Healing, Prayer, and Remembrance. It's the first of its kind. It is a place where you'll find an altar, memorials, information, and what's known as the Red Book. And the Red Book lists the names of thousands of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Here's Lily Mendoza.
You know, this crisis has been happening since the colonization here in America, which means, you know, from non-natives coming onto our land from all four directions across the earth. And so that began, you know, many hundreds of years ago that was taking place. And so it kind of has just evolved as far as our communities and our people really taking note of that and paying attention to that, you know, within the last 15 to 20 years and saying, you know, our Indigenous women, they're being murdered and they're missing. And so we kind of started to take stock of that throughout Canada, throughout the United States, and even overseas. And so what we've done is, like I said, taken stock in that and began to do awareness and education around the issue. But it really did begin, you know, hundreds of years ago for our women.
You can find a lot more from Lily Mendoza on our website at sdpb.org/news and the work of the Red Ribbon Skirt Society. So when my daughter was little, she liked to hide under those circular clothing racks in department stores. And another mother gave me this advice, and I remember it all these years later. If a toddler goes missing in a store, you should make a lot of noise. Don't go quietly to a cashier and whisper that you may have lost your child. She's wearing a red shirt. Start shouting that child's name so as many people as possible know to help find them immediately. If your child is stolen, you need a lot of adults on your side, and you need them as soon as possible. Here is what we heard from several of our guests on this topic. When an Indigenous girl or woman goes missing, it is not uncommon for people to simply suggest she will turn up again. Maybe she's off partying, somebody might say. Maybe you should be patient and wait for her to call. But in any missing person's case, from toddler to adult, time is essential. Assumptions and stereotypes impede investigations. Mistrust of law enforcement can delay reporting. Well, SDPB's Lee Strubinger covered the search this month for 30-year-old Susan Fast Eagle. She's been missing since early May. He spoke here with Sunny Redbear. Redbear is director of racial equity at NDN Collective. And Redbear says it takes people demanding action to impact change. In other words, people need to make some noise.
Without action, without actually getting out there and doing the searches and demanding change and the grassroots, like the movements within the communities, nothing will ever change. we will just continue to have missing people. This is something that has happened, for hundreds of years.
And here is one of Susan Fast Eagle's relatives. This is her brother-in-law, Wayne Chief Eagle, and he's promising his niece that he will not stop looking. Local police have promised to continue looking for Fast Eagle as well.
You know, I'm going to do what I have to do to help find your mom. So that's why I'm out here, because, you know, I have a heart. I love her as my sister because she's been in our life so long. You know, I'm praying that I hope we don't find her along the creek, because if we do, then, you know, that's bad.
Listening to these stories and letting the reality of this crisis sink in can be emotional work. Discovering a relative who has been killed or driving to another state to pick up a body is devastating for family members. On May 5th, people gathered at the state capitol building and pier, and they shared their stories of grief, trauma, and loss. SDPB's Jackie Hendry and Crystal Schoenbauer were there, and they recorded hours of this powerful and emotional testimony. Here is Sharon Bringsplenty, standing outside the capitol, talking about finding her daughter, Tessa.
I don't know how to get through the day, but I pray and pray a lot. I pray for answers, pray for justice for my daughter, Tessa. She didn't deserve to die like that. Not for her mother to find her. Something that I will never, ever forget, never get out of my mind. Somebody comes and asks me, do you need anything? What do you need? I just need your prayers. I just need your prayers. Prayers for strength to get me through this. Till we find out who did this to my daughter and why. Why did they do that? She didn't deserve to die that way. Not like that. Not the way I found her. No. No mother should go through that. She had a lot going. She was talking about going, she danced as a fancy dancer as a little girl. And I lost another daughter back in May of 2019. So after that 1 year, she talked about going back into the dance arena as a traditional dancer. And she bought the material, and we were gonna start making her regalia. The first place she wanted to dance was up in Stanford, Palo Alto, California. We had all these plans. Now those plans will never happen.
Behind every statistic is a story, a human life upended by loss and unanswered questions. For Indigenous women, almost every family I have talked to has a story of a relative lost. That trauma is often unresolved. It lives in bodies, it lives in families, it lives in communities. If we are, in fact, all related, it lives in each one of us, too. Now, we have seen increased federal, state, and tribal efforts to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the past few years, but so much more work needs to be done. You can find hours of our coverage on this topic on our website. It's the Spotlight series for the month of May, sdpb.org/spotlight. Today, I want to leave you with one more thought, and this one is for the women and girls who have been exploited, threatened, made to go places you didn't want to go, do things that you didn't want to do. We're going to hear now from Lisa Heth. She's executive director for the Pathfinder Center. It's a refuge for victims of human trafficking, and she spoke with SDPB's Jackie Hendry. Here, Jackie asks Lisa for insight into the healing journey for survivors.
Well, I just want to say to every survivor of sex trafficking, any survivor, sexual assault that has happened to them, that it is not your fault. It's the perpetrator's fault. They made the choice to do what they did, no matter what means that they used. It was their choice. They knew what they were doing. And no matter what age, whether you were a minor or an adult, they took advantage of you. They used power and control. They knew what they were doing, the manipulations and that, to control you and manipulate you. And none of it was your fault. Stop blaming yourself. If you're getting help right now, continue on that journey. If you're not in a place where you're being helped, reach out. Our healing sometimes takes a lifetime. I mean, I'm still dealing from stuff. And I mean, I'm a survivor myself of sexual assault. And, you know, I've been healing for years. There's a lot of things that I've let go. There's things that I've blamed myself for and realized, like, how could I? You know, I was a child. And that you have a purpose, you have a destiny, and Creator does want to heal you. He wants you to be healed. He wants you to be whole. And Creator wants you to know that He's there whenever you need to help. You just need to call out.
The National Hotline to Report Human Trafficking is 1-800-373-7888. We have more resources and stories on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Let's take a moment now, and we're going to head to Perkins County, South Dakota. Eliza Blue lives there with her husband, her two small children, and an array of livestock and animals. Every month, she sends an audio postcard to the world about life on the ranch, about life in today's world. Here is her postcard from the prairie for May.
Small-scale shepherding is not a lucrative undertaking, especially when one has a fiber flock mostly composed of pets. In an effort to not lose money on my shepherding habit, I started a business with an old friend a few years ago called Plain Song Fiber. She lives in the Pacific Northwest, where there are fiber enthusiasts aplenty, as well as an abundance of fiber festivals and yarn shops. Once or twice a year, she comes out for an extended visit to help with the sheep, skirt and sort fleeces, and spin wool before taking the pick of that year's shearing to Seattle. My friend and her daughter arrived this week for their annual visit to bright sun and high temperatures. But Seattle must have missed them, and almost immediately the dry heat shifted to mist and rain. We aren't complaining, and neither is the grass after the last few months of drought. Even the sheep and the lambs, damp through their fine curly coats, don't seem to mind. They are happy to be out nibbling on fresh stems instead of the last wisps of winter hay. It also means we are spending a lot of time in the outbuilding we've been slowly converting to a fiber studio. The building had been used as a storage shed, but in its poured concrete floor and sound structure, I saw promise. Over the last few years, we've tinned the roof, added a small lean-to greenhouse, replaced the ancient, impossible-to-open garage doors, and put in an old wood stove. While aesthetically it still looks more like a shed than anything else, calling it a studio no longer sounds aspirational. I was contemplating this progress when we lit a fire in the wood stove this morning. My friend had set up her spinning wheel next to the stove, and the wheel's quiet whir accompanied the snap and crackle of the logs as they burned. Our mama cat and her latest batch of kittens have a cozy bed in the studio as well, and the kids played with the chubby babies while I sorted wool, rain tapping gently on the roof. I'm a person with a lot of ideas. too many ideas, it often seems. The capacity of my imagination always bigger than the time, energy, or resources at my disposal. This tendency leaves me feeling that no matter how fast I run, I am always running behind. Our fledgling fiber business is a perfect example. We could be hustling harder, posting more cute pictures and fun stories to social media, working to cultivate relationships with shops and online influencers to build our brand. But between ranching, mothering, and my work as a writer and musician, I actually can't hustle any harder. I'm already overextended. When I was younger, I imagined eventually I would figure out how to reach the end of my daily to-do list with time left over to sit outside and sip an artfully concocted beverage in my well-tended garden. Now, firmly ensconced in middle age, I consider it an accomplishment to drink a full glass of water, and I've had to admit, if I want any garden at all, it will never be well-tended. Looking over at my friend and our children using this space just as I'd imagined we would, a dream growing, albeit slowly, toward fruition, it should feel like a victory. Instead, I see the cobwebs and unfinished walls, the tubs of dirty wool, the hours of work ahead, and I am exhausted before I begin. The real work of my adulthood, it turns out, is not learning how to do it all. It's about learning how to joyfully leave work undone. It's about looking at an unfinished project and seeing all the progress instead of all that's left to do. It's about carving out space and the relentlessness of my own expectations to be still. Outside, the rain falls steadily, seeping through dusty soil to roots that have been waiting patiently for a drink. A drink that arrives later than expected, but still in plenty of time to grow a prairie's worth of summer blooms.
You can follow Eliza Blue by going to elizablue.net. Well, live jazz returns in a big way. We talk Jazz Week ahead on the program You're in the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
After being closed for more than a year, theaters over in the UK are opening back up, with restrictions, of course. But it has been a long spell for cast and crew that have been out of work.
All my actor friends have had to turn to other things. I mean, whether that's delivery driving, working in supermarkets.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a touring theater company, staging a comeback next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB. Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sioux Falls Jazz and Blues Society announced yesterday Jazz and Blues Week for July. And some of the events and attractions include live concerts and pop-up shows, jazz camp, an exhibit on the history of Jazz Fest, and a lot more. And joining us now in the Kirby Family Studio in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio, we have Alex Gilbert-Schrog, Executive Director of the Sioux Falls Jazz and Blues Society. Alex, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Lori. It's exciting to be here.
We've got guests in our studio face-to-face, and we've got live jazz returning to the region. It's been a tough year. Tell us a little bit about what it's like right now to be releasing big event news after all the transitions of the past, 12 to 18 months.
I honestly feel like it's a dream. I can't believe that I actually sent out a press release with all of those events on it. A year ago, we weren't even planning anything for the summer, really, yeah. Because there was just so much unknown, what was going to happen tomorrow, a week, from now. And so to be able to actually sit down and have events and tickets go on sale, it's something I will never take for granted again.
Right. Yeah. And I will never take for granted sitting in a live music venue and just feeling the energy of that.
Yes.
Because that was one of the things that I missed the most, the movie theaters,
mm-hmm.
other than people I love, right?
But right.
I love going to the movies, and I love live music, and especially live jazz at some of those venues. Now, everything yes. that we're doing right now is like the next normal, not a return to normal. Mm-hmm. So this is a jazz week. Tell us a little bit about it.
So we have a variety of events happening, and really the Jazz and Blues Week, so many artists still aren't touring. Different states are opening up at different rates, so it's hard to really plan for something as big as what would have been, a festival.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted this Jazz and Blues Week to focus on our local musicians, our local businesses, organizations, getting to work with, people in our community who are also coming out of the pandemic. And so that was really the focus of it. And we've got everything from Phil Baker doing a kids concert mm-hmm. to the Haig Brothers Band performing for free at the McKinnon Park. And then one of my favorites, which is going to be a lot of fun and a first for us, will be the Gourmet Wine and Jazz event at our wine bar with Skyeski Catering doing the food. And we're pairing music with food and wine. So, there'll be a lot of fun things to talk about there. And I think that'll be a really good event for people to get to come out and taste really great food and wine, but also get to listen to some of our best musicians that we have in yeah. Sioux Falls.
So that is one of the venues that's relatively new. And talk a little bit about this idea of, bringing a week-long engagement like this in different places. We're also the economic impact of that instead of, one big splash, at a soccer field versus like, come check out this venue, come check out this part of town, try this from a local winery. How do you sort of see yourself as an arts organization integrating into that economic development and economic impact of a community like Sioux Falls?
Well, what's great about Jazz and Blues Week is some of the events that are part of it, we do on a regular basis. So it was an mm-hmm. opportunity for us to elevate how we impact the community on a regular schedule anyway. So for example, Severance Brewing Company and our wine bar have become regular venues for us where we do book musicians, but not everybody maybe knows that that's a regular thing that happens. And so I'm excited to get to start to help elevate some of our local businesses in different ways than what they might be known for.
Yeah.
And then of course, with Jazz Camp is coming back. We canceled it completely last year just due to so many logistical challenges of trying to do jazz virtually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little yeah. hard to improvise together when you're on different screens and yeah. delays and technology. And so, with Jazz Camp, that also provides us an opportunity to showcase our youth and the future. And hopefully getting them to the point where they can get performing opportunities in Sioux Falls. And for example, we started a youth jazz night at our wine bar. So we do one Wednesday every mm-hmm. month at our wine bar where it's a youth jazz ensemble. So it's really all about keeping it in the community financially, hiring all of the musicians. Of course, Tab Benoit is not
yes.
local, but
yes.
It was nice to be able to do a mix of events yeah. with different folks across the state.
But talk about Tab Benoit, because that's a big name. A lot of people are going to get in their cars and make a plan to drive to the region to see that show.
Well, I'm just glad that he was touring, that we
yeah.
could even get him. But so Tab Benoit will be coming back to perform at the district on Sunday, July 11th. And, before when I came on to the position in January, I'd even reached out to his tour manager then to see if we could set up a show. And then
yeah.
everything happened with the pandemic, so it was put on hold. But, you know, he's a fantastic musician. He's played at Jazz Fest multiple times. He has also participated in our concert series. So I'm just really glad that there's an opportunity to bring people together in a live concert setting and listening to, you know, some really legitimate blues music. It'll be really fun to see people come together for that.
Now let's go all the way down to those little kids, because you mentioned Phil Baker. And I want to ask you about when you think about your work with the Jazz and Blues Society, you know, like the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra or playhouses and theater companies that are trying to figure out how to be a part of a community, how to think about economic development, how to, you know, encourage the musicians of the future who might be professional musicians. And then there's this also, you know, the sense of these kids who have been behind a screen for so long and we're trying to figure out. And Phil Baker, boy, he pivoted great, you know, during the pandemic to try to figure out how to reach those kids. But now they can see him in person. Talk about the little guys a little bit, the little folks, and what they can kind of get plugged into early on for music.
So during the pandemic, like you're saying, Phil really helped not only, you know, he did a great job pivoting himself, but he helped us. We ended up creating the Music Maker and Me program, which was an online series of 10 episodes. And it was great to see him do that and to do the live virtual concerts and reach some of those kids. And you got feedback on the comment section from daycare centers or parents who were tuning in saying their kids were dancing and boogieing and they had it loud on the speaker. But it was a world of difference when we actually took that program out on tour and visited 5 different organizations across Sioux Falls. Yeah. You need that in-person reaction. And it's not saying that every little kid will become a musician or ever pick up, you know, anything on the piano. It's just helping to teach them to appreciate music and what it can do for you at such a young age can propel them into so many different things. Right. I myself was a musician since the age of 3 and realized I hated being on stage, and that's kind of a problem if you want to be a professional musician. So getting to do the arts organization part of it, where I'm doing the admin, I get to elevate the people that do love to perform and be on stage. And I never would have found that out if I hadn't been involved in music at a young age.
Well, I can just say gratitude for your organization and for Phil Baker, because for me as an adult without little preschool kids, just watching that first time that, you know, did that online, it grounded all of us in the fact that, oh, you know, Phil Baker's still here. Mm-hmm. Sesame Street is still here. There are things that were consistent, and I think for a lot of kids who tune into him and the work that he's doing, seeing him on that screen was like, yep, it's going to be okay. Life hasn't completely upended. And for a lot of people in the region, Jazz Week, we're not done.
No.
It comes back. Give us the dates before we let you go.
Yes, it'll be July 10th through the 18th. The exhibit will run the whole week, and then we'll have various events every day. And you can find all of that on our website.
And we'll put a link to that website up on our website as well. Alex Gilbert-Schrock, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.